This is Audible.
The Untethered Soul. The Journey Beyond Yourself. By Michael A. Singer. Narrated by Peter Burkrot. Copyright 2007 by Michael A. Singer. The Untethered Soul is a registered trademark of Shanti Productions, Incorporated. This unabridged audio is published by arrangement with New Harbinger Publications, Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2011 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Introduction. This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. William Shakespeare. Shakespeare's age-honored words, spoken by Polonius to his son Laertes in Act I of Hamlet, sound so clear and unambiguous. They tell us that to maintain honest relations with others, we must first be true to ourselves. Yet if Laertes were to be totally honest with himself, he would realize that his father may as well have told him to catch the wind. After all, to which self are we to be true? Is it the one that shows up when we're in a bad mood, or the one that is present when we feel humbled by our mistakes? Is it the one who speaks from the dark recesses of the heart when we're depressed or upset, or the one that appears during those fleeting moments when life seems so fanciful and light? From these questions, we see that the concept of self may turn out to be a bit more elusive than initially presumed. Perhaps if Laertes could have turned to traditional psychology, it would have shed some light on the subject. Freud, the father of psychology, divided the psyche into three parts: the id, the ego, and the superego. He saw the id as our primal animal nature, the superego as the judgment system that society has instilled within us, and the ego as our representative to the outside world that struggles to maintain a balance between the other two powerful forces. But this certainly would not have helped young Laertes. After all, to which of these conflicting forces are we to be true? Again, we see that things are not always as simple as they seem. If we dare to look past the surface of the term self, questions arise that many people would rather not ask. Are the many aspects of my being all equally part of myself, or is there only one of me? And if so, which, where, how, and why? In the following chapters, we will undertake a journey of exploration of self, but we will not do so in a traditional manner. We will neither call upon the experts in psychology, nor upon the great philosophers. We will not argue and choose between time-honored religious views, or resort to statistically supported surveys of people's opinions. We will instead turn to a single source that has phenomenal direct knowledge on the subject. We will turn to one expert who, for every moment of every day of their life, has been collecting the data necessary to finally put this great inquiry to rest. And that expert is you. But before you get too excited or decide that you're not up to the task, first, be clear that we're not after your views or opinions on the subject. Neither are we interested in what books you have read, classes you have taken, nor seminars you have attended. We are only interested in your intuitive experience of what it is like to be you. We are not looking for your knowledge. We are seeking your direct experience. You see, you can't fail at this because yourself is what you are, at all times and in all places. We simply need to sort it out. After all, it can get quite confusing in there. The chapters of this book are nothing but mirrors for seeing yourself from different angles. And though the journey we are about to embark on is an inner one, it will draw upon every aspect of your life. The only requirement asked of you is the willingness to honestly look at yourself in the most natural, intuitive manner. Remember, if we are seeking the root of self, what we are actually seeking is you. As you listen to this book, you will find that you know much more than you thought you did about some very deep subjects. The fact is, you already know how to find yourself. You have just gotten distracted and disoriented. Once refocused, you will realize that you not only have the ability to find yourself, you have the ability to free yourself. Whether you choose to do so or not is entirely up to you, but upon completion of your journey through these chapters, there will be no more confusion, no more lack of empowerment, and no more blaming others. You will know exactly what must be done. And should you choose to devote yourself to the ongoing journey of self-realization, you will develop a tremendous sense of respect for who you really are. It is only then that you will come to appreciate the full depth of meaning in the advice, "This above all, to thine own self be true." Part 1. Awakening Consciousness. Chapter 1. The Voice Inside Your Head.
Shoot, I can't remember her name. What is her name? Darn, here she comes. What is it? Sally? Sue? She just told me yesterday. What's the matter with me? This is going to be embarrassing.
In case you haven't noticed, you have a mental dialogue going on inside your head that never stops. It just keeps going and going. Have you ever wondered why it talks in there? How does it decide what to say and when to say it? How much of what it says turns out to be true? How much of what it says is even important? And if right now you are hearing, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have any voice inside my head," that's the voice we're talking about. And if you're smart, you'll take the time to step back, examine this voice, and get to know it better. The problem is you're too close to be objective. You have to step way back and watch it converse. While you're driving, you hear internal conversations like this.
"Wasn't I supposed to call Fred? I should have. Oh my God, I can't believe I forgot. He's going to be so mad. He may never talk to me again. Maybe I should stop and call him right now. No, I don't want to stop the car right now."
Notice that the voice takes both sides of the conversation. It doesn't care which side it takes, just as long as it gets to keep on talking. When you're tired and trying to sleep, it's the voice inside your head that says,
"What am I doing? I can't go to sleep yet. I forgot to call Fred. I remembered in the car, but I didn't call. If I don't call now... Oh, wait, it's too late. I shouldn't call him now. I don't even know why I thought about it. I need to fall asleep. Oh, shoot, now I can't fall asleep. I'm not tired anymore. But I have a big day tomorrow, and I have to get up early."
No wonder you can't sleep. Why do you even tolerate that voice talking to you all the time? Even if what it's saying is soothing and nice, it's still disturbing everything you're doing. If you spend some time observing this mental voice, the first thing you will notice is that it never shuts up. When left to its own, it just talks. Imagine if you were to see someone walking around constantly talking to himself. You'd think he was strange. You'd wonder, if he's the one who's talking and he's the one who's listening, he obviously knows what's going to be said before he says it, so what's the point? The same is true for the voice inside your head. Why is it talking? It's you who's talking, and it's you who's listening. And when the voice argues with itself, who is it arguing with? Who could possibly win? It gets very confusing. Just listen. "I think I should get married." "No, you know you're not ready. You'll be sorry."
"But I love him."
"Oh, come on, you felt that way about Tom. What if you had married him?" If you watch carefully, you'll see that it's just trying to find a comfortable place to rest. It will change sides in a moment if that seems to help. And it doesn't even quiet down when it finds out that it's wrong. It simply adjusts its viewpoint and keeps on going. If you pay attention, these mental patterns will become obvious to you. It's actually a shocking realization when you notice that your mind is constantly talking. You might even try to yell at it in a feeble attempt to shut it up, but then you realize that's the voice yelling at the voice. "Shut up, I want to go to sleep. Why do you have to talk all the time?" Obviously, you can't shut it up that way. The best way to free yourself from this incessant chatter is to step back and view it objectively. Just view the voice as a vocalizing mechanism that is capable of making it appear like someone is in there talking to you. Don't think about it, just notice it. No matter what the voice is saying, it's all the same. It doesn't matter if it's saying nice things or mean things, worldly things or spiritual things. It doesn't matter because it's still just a voice talking inside your head. In fact, the only way to get your distance from this voice is to stop differentiating what it's saying. Stop feeling that one thing it says is you and the other thing it says is not you. If you're hearing it talk, it's obviously not you. You are the one who hears the voice. You are the one who notices that it's talking. You do hear it when it talks, don't you? Make it say, hello, right now. Say it over and over a few times. Now shout it inside. Can you hear yourself saying hello inside? Of course you can. There is a voice talking, and there is you who notices the voice talking. The problem is that it's easy to notice the voice saying hello, but it's difficult to see that no matter what the voice says, it is still just a voice talking and you listening. There is absolutely nothing that voice can say that is more you than anything else it says. Suppose you were looking at three objects, a flower pot, a photograph, and a book, and were then asked, which of these objects is you? You'd say, none of them. I'm the one who's looking at what you're putting in front of me. It doesn't matter what you put in front of me, it's always going to be me looking at it. You see, it's an act of a subject perceiving various objects. This is also true of hearing the voice inside. It doesn't make any difference what it's saying. You are the one who is aware of it. As long as you think that one thing it's saying is you, but the other thing it's saying is not you, you've lost your objectivity. You may want to think of yourself as the part that says the nice things, but that's still the voice talking. You may like what it says, but it's not you. There is nothing more important to true growth than realizing that you are not the voice of the mind. You are the one who hears it. If you don't understand this, you will try to figure out which of the many things the voice says is really you. People go through so many changes in the name of trying to find myself. They want to discover which of these voices, which of these aspects of their personality, is who they really are. The answer is simple. None of them. If you watch it objectively, you will come to see that much of what the voice says is meaningless. Most of the talking is just a waste of time and energy. The truth is that most of life will unfold in accordance with forces far outside your control, regardless of what your mind says about it. It's like sitting down at night and deciding whether you want the sun to come up in the morning. The bottom line is, the sun will come up and the sun will go down. Billions of things are going on in this world. You can think about it all you want, but life is still going to keep on happening. In fact, your thoughts have far less impact on this world than you would like to think. If you're willing to be objective and watch all your thoughts, you will see that the vast majority of them have no relevance. They have no effect on anything or anybody except you. They are simply making you feel better or worse about what is going on now, what has gone on in the past, or what might go on in the future. If you spend your time hoping that it doesn't rain tomorrow, you're wasting your time. Your thoughts don't change the rain. You will someday come to see that there is no use for that incessant internal chatter, and there is no reason to constantly attempt to figure everything out. Eventually, you will see that the real cause of problems is not life itself. It's the commotion the mind makes about life that really causes problems. Now, this raises a serious question. If so much of what the voice says is meaningless and unnecessary, then why does it even exist? The secret to answering this question lies in understanding why it says what it says when it says it. For example, in some cases the mental voice talks for the same reason that a tea kettle whistles. That is, there's a buildup of energy inside that needs to be released. If you watch objectively, you will see that when there's a buildup of nervous, fearful, or desire-based energies inside, the voice becomes extremely active. This is easy to see when you are angry with someone and you feel like telling them off. Just watch how many times the inner voice tells them off before you even see them. When energy builds up inside, you want to do something about it. That voice talks because you're not okay inside, and talking releases energy. You will notice, however, that even when you're not particularly bothered by something, it still talks. When you're walking down the street, it says things like, look at that dog. It's a Labrador. Hey, there's another dog in that car. He looks a lot like my first dog, Shadow. Whoa, there's an old Oldsmobile. It's got Alaska plates. You don't see many of those down here. It is actually narrating the world for you. But why do you need this? You already see what's happening outside. How does it help to repeat it to yourself through the mental voice? You should examine this very closely. With a simple glance, you instantly take in the tremendous detail of whatever you're looking at. If you see a tree, you effortlessly see the branches, the leaves, and the flowering buds. Why then do you have to verbalize what you have already seen? Look at that dogwood. The green leaves are so beautiful against the white flowers. Look how many flowers there are. Wow, it's so full. What you'll see, if you study this carefully, is that the narration makes you feel more comfortable with the world around you. Like backseat driving, it makes you feel as though things are more in your control. You actually feel like you have some relationship with them. A tree is no longer just a tree in the world that has nothing to do with you. It is a tree that you saw, labeled, and judged. By verbalizing it mentally, you brought that initial direct experience of the world into the realm of your thoughts. There it becomes integrated with your other thoughts, such as those making up your value system and historical experiences. Take a moment to examine the difference between your experience of the outside world and your interactions with the mental world. When you're just thinking, you're free to create whatever thoughts you want in your mind, and these thoughts are expressed through the voice. You are very accustomed to settling into the playground of the mind and creating and manipulating thoughts. This inner world is an alternate environment that is under your control. The outside world, however, marches to its own laws. When the voice narrates the outside world to you, those thoughts are now side by side in parity with all your other thoughts. All these thoughts intermix and actually influence your experience of the world around you. What you end up experiencing is really a personal presentation of the world according to you, rather than the stark, unfiltered experience of what is really out there. This mental manipulation of the outer experience allows you to buffer reality as it comes in. For example, there are myriad things that you see at any given moment, yet you only narrate a few of them. The ones you discuss in your mind are the ones that matter to you. With this subtle form of pre-processing, you manage to control the experience of reality so that it all fits together inside your mind. Your consciousness is actually experiencing your mental model of reality, not reality itself. You have to watch this very carefully because you do it all the time. You're walking outside in the winter. You start to shiver and the voice says, "It's cold." Now, how did that help you? You already knew it was cold. You're the one who's experiencing the cold. Why is it telling you this? You recreate the world within your mind, because you can control your mind, whereas you can't control the world. That is why you mentally talk about it. If you can't get the world the way you like it, you internally verbalize it, judge it, complain about it, and then decide what to do about it. This makes you feel more empowered. When your body experiences cold, there may be nothing you can do to affect the temperature. But when your mind verbalizes it's cold, you can say, "We're almost home, just a few more minutes." Now you feel better. In the thought world, there's always something you can do to control the experience. Basically, you recreate the outside world inside yourself, and then you live in your mind. What if you decided not to do this? If you decide not to narrate, and instead just consciously observe the world, you will feel more open and exposed. This is because you really don't know what will happen next, and your mind is accustomed to helping you. It does this by processing your current experiences in a way that makes them fit with your views of the past and visions of the future. All of this helps to create a semblance of control. If your mind doesn't do this, you simply become too uncomfortable. Reality is just too real for most of us, so we temper it with the mind. You will come to see that the mind talks all the time because you gave it a job to do. You use it as a protection mechanism, a form of defense. Ultimately, it makes you feel more secure. As long as that's what you want, you will be forced to constantly use your mind to buffer yourself from life, instead of living it. The world is unfolding, and really has very little to do with you or your thoughts. It was here long before you came, and it will be here long after you leave. In the name of attempting to hold the world together, you're really just trying to hold yourself together. True personal growth is about transcending the part of you that is not okay and needs protection. This is done by constantly remembering that you are the one inside that notices the voice talking. That is the way out. The one inside who is aware that you are always talking to yourself about yourself is always silent. It is a doorway to the depths of your being. To be aware that you are watching the voice talk is to stand on the threshold of a fantastic inner journey. If used properly, the same mental voice that has been a source of worry, distraction, and general neurosis can become the launching ground for true spiritual awakening. Come to know the one who watches the voice, and you will come to know one of the great mysteries of creation. Chapter 2. Your Inner Roommate. Your inner growth is completely dependent upon the realization that the only way to find peace and contentment is to stop thinking about yourself. You're ready to grow when you finally realize that the I who is always talking inside will never be content. It always has a problem with something. Honestly, when was the last time you really had nothing bothering you? Before you had your current problem, there was a different problem. And if you're wise, you will realize that after this one's gone, there will be another one. The bottom line is, you'll never be free of problems until you are free from the part within that has so many problems. When a problem is disturbing you, don't ask, "What should I do about it?" Ask, "What part of me is being disturbed by this?" If you ask, "What should I do about it?" you've already fallen into believing that there really is a problem outside that must be dealt with. If you want to achieve peace in the face of your problems, you must understand why you perceive a particular situation as a problem. If you're feeling jealousy, instead of trying to see how you can protect yourself, just ask, "What part of me is jealous?" That will cause you to look inside and see that there's a part of you that's having a problem with jealousy. Once you clearly see the disturbed part, then ask, "Who is it that sees this? Who notices this inner disturbance?" Asking this is the solution to your every problem. The very fact that you can see the disturbance means that you are not it. The process of seeing something requires a subject-object relationship. The subject is called the witness, because it is the one who sees what's happening. The object is what you are seeing, in this case, the inner disturbance. This act of maintaining objective awareness of the inner problem is always better than losing yourself in the outer situation. This is the essential difference between a spiritually minded person and a worldly person. Worldly doesn't mean that you have money or stature. Worldly means that you think the solution to your inner problems is in the world outside. You think that if you change things outside, you'll be okay. But nobody has ever truly become okay by changing things outside. There's always the next problem. The only real solution is to take the seat of witness consciousness and completely change your frame of reference. To attain true inner freedom, you must be able to objectively watch your problems instead of being lost in them. No solution can possibly exist while you're lost in the energy of a problem. Everyone knows you can't deal well with a situation if you're getting anxious, scared, or angry about it. The first problem you have to deal with is your own reaction. You will not be able to solve anything outside until you own how the situation affects you inside. Problems are generally not what they appear to be. When you get clear enough, you will realize that the real problem is that there is something inside of you that can have a problem with almost anything. The first step is to deal with that part of you. This involves a change from outer solution consciousness to inner solution consciousness. You have to break the habit of thinking that the solution to your problems is to rearrange things outside. The only permanent solution to your problems is to go inside and let go of the part of you that seems to have so many problems with reality. Once you do that, you'll be clear enough to deal with what's left. There really is a way to let go of the part of you that sees everything as a problem. It may seem impossible, but it's not. There is a part of your being that can actually abstract from your own melodrama. You can watch yourself be jealous or angry. You don't have to think about it or analyze it. You can just be aware of it. Who is it that sees all this? Who notices the changes going on inside? When you tell a friend, "Every time I talk to Tom, it gets me so upset," how do you know it gets you upset? You know that it gets you upset because you're in there, and you see what's going on in there. There's a separation between you and the anger or the jealousy. You are the one who's in there noticing these things. Once you take that seat of consciousness, you can get rid of these personal disturbances. You start by watching. Just be aware that you are aware of what is going on in there. It's easy. What you'll notice is that you're watching a human being's personality with all its strengths and weaknesses. It's as though there's somebody in there with you. You might actually say you have a roommate. If you would like to meet your roommate, just try to sit inside yourself for a while in complete solitude and silence. You have the right. It's your inner domain. But instead of finding silence, you're going to listen to incessant chatter. Why am I doing this? I have more important things to do. This is a waste of time. There's nobody in here but me. What's this all about? Right on cue, there's your roommate. You may have a clear intention to be quiet inside, but your roommate won't cooperate. And it's not just when you try to be quiet. It has something to say about everything you look at. I like it, I don't like it, this is good, that's bad. It just talks and talks. You don't generally notice because you don't step back from it. You're so close that you don't realize that you're actually hypnotized into listening to it. Basically, you're not alone in there. There are two distinct aspects of your inner being. The first is you, the awareness, the witness, the center of your willful intentions. And the other is that which you watch. The problem is, the part that you watch never shuts up. If you could get rid of that part, even for a moment, the peace and serenity would be the nicest vacation you've ever had. Imagine what it would be like if you didn't have to bring this thing with you wherever you go. Real spiritual growth is about getting out of this predicament. But first you have to realize that you've been locked in there with a maniac. In any situation or circumstance, your roommate could suddenly decide, I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this. I don't want to talk to this person. You would immediately feel tense and uncomfortable. Your roommate can ruin anything you're doing without a moment's notice. It could ruin your wedding day, or even your wedding night. That part of you can ruin anything and everything, and it generally does. You buy a brand new car and it's beautiful, but every time you drive it, your inner roommate finds something wrong with it. The mental voice keeps pointing out every little squeak, every little vibration, until eventually you don't even like the car anymore. Once you see what this can do to your life, you are ready for spiritual growth. You're ready for real transformation when you finally say, look at this thing. It's ruining my life. I'm trying to live a peaceful, meaningful existence, but I feel like I'm sitting on top of a volcano. At any moment, this thing can decide to freak, close down, and fight with what's happening. One day it likes someone, and the next day it decides to pick on everything they do. My life is a mess just because this thing that lives in here with me has to make a melodrama out of everything. Once you've seen this and learned to no longer identify with your roommate, you're ready to free yourself. If you haven't reached this awareness yet, just start to watch. Spend a day watching every single thing your roommate does. Start in the morning and see if you can notice what it's saying in every situation. Every time you meet somebody, every time the phone rings, just try to watch. A good time to watch it talk is while you're taking a shower. Just watch what that voice has to say. You will see that it never lets you just take a peaceful shower. Your shower is for washing the body, not for watching the mind talk nonstop. See if you can stay conscious enough throughout the entire experience to be aware of what's going on. You'll be shocked by what you see. It just jumps from one subject to the next. The incessant chatter seems so neurotic that you won't believe that it's always that way. But it is. You have to watch this if you want to be free of it. You don't have to do anything about it, but you have to get wise to the predicament you're in. You have to realize that somehow you've ended up with a mess for an inner roommate. If you want it to be peaceful in there, you're going to have to fix this situation. The way to catch on to what your inner roommate is really like is to personify it externally. Make believe that your roommate, the psyche, has a body of its own. You do this by taking the entire personality that you hear talking to you inside and imagine it as a person talking to you on the outside. Just imagine that another person is now saying everything that your inner voice would say. Now, spend a day with that person. You've just sat down to watch your favorite TV show. The problem is you have this person with you. Now you'll get to hear the same incessant monologue that used to be inside, except that it's sitting next to you on the couch talking to itself. Did you turn off the light downstairs? You better go check. Not now, I'll do it later. I want to finish watching the show. No, do it now, that's why the electric bill is so high. You sit in silent awe watching all of this. Then a few seconds later, your couchmate is engaged in another dispute. Hey, I want to get something to eat. I'm craving some pizza. No, you can't have pizza now. It's too far to drive. But I'm hungry. When will I get to eat? To your amazement, these neurotic bursts of conflicting dialogue just keep going on and on. And as if that's not enough, instead of simply watching TV, this person starts verbally reacting to whatever comes on the screen. At one point, after a redhead appears on the show, your couchmate starts mumbling about an ex-spouse and a painful divorce. Then the yelling starts, just as though the ex-spouse were in the room with you. Then it stops, just as suddenly as it started. At this point, you find yourself hugging the far corner of the couch in a desperate attempt to get as far away from this disturbed person as you possibly can. Will you dare to do this experiment? Don't try to make the person stop talking. Just try to get to know what you live with inside by externalizing the voice. Give it a body and put it out there in the world just like everybody else. Let it be a person who says on the outside exactly what the voice of your mind says inside. Now make that person your best friend. After all, how many friends do you spend all of your time with and pay absolute attention to every word they say? How would you feel if someone outside really started talking to you the way your inner voice does? How would you relate to a person who opened their mouth to say everything your mental voice says? After a very short period of time, you would tell them to leave and never come back. But when your inner friend continuously speaks up, you don't ever tell it to leave. No matter how much trouble it causes, you listen. There's almost nothing that voice can say that you don't pay full attention to. It pulls you right out of whatever you're doing, no matter how enjoyable, and suddenly you're paying attention to whatever it has to say. Imagine that you're in a serious relationship and are about to get married. You're driving to the wedding and it says, "Maybe this is not the right person. I'm really getting nervous about this. What should I do?" If someone outside of you said that, you'd ignore them. But you feel you owe the voice an answer. You have to convince your nervous mind that this is the right person, or it won't let you walk down the aisle. That's how much respect you have for this neurotic thing inside of you. You know that if you don't listen to it, it will bother you every day of your life. I told you not to get married. I said I wasn't sure. The bottom line is undeniable. If somehow that voice managed to manifest in a body outside of you, and you had to take it with you everywhere you went, you wouldn't last a day. If somebody were to ask you what your new friend is like, you'd say, "This is one seriously disturbed person. Just look up neurosis in the dictionary and you'll get the picture." That being the case, once you've spent a day with your friend, what is the probability you'd go to them for advice? After seeing how often this person changed their mind, how conflicted they were on so many subjects, and how emotionally overreactive they tended to be, would you ever ask them for relationship or financial advice? As amazing as it seems, you do just that every moment of your life. Having taken its rightful place back inside of you, it is still the same person who tells you what to do about every aspect of your life. Have you ever bothered to check its credentials? How many times has that voice been totally wrong? She doesn't care for you anymore. That's why she hasn't called. She's going to break up with you tonight. I can feel it coming. I just know it. You shouldn't even answer the phone if she calls. After 30 minutes of this, the phone rings and it's your girlfriend. She's late because it's your one-year anniversary and she was preparing for a surprise dinner. It was definitely a surprise to you, since you completely forgot the anniversary. She says she's on her way over to pick you up. Well, you're very excited, and your inner voice is chatting about how great she is. But haven't you forgotten something? Haven't you forgotten about the bad advice the inner voice gave you that caused you to suffer for the last half hour? What if you had hired a relationship advisor who had given you that terrible advice? They had completely misread the entire situation. Had you listened to your advisor, you never would have picked up the phone. Wouldn't you fire them on the spot? How could you ever trust their advice again after seeing how wrong they were? Well, are you going to fire your inner roommate? After all, its advice and analysis of the situation were totally wrong. Now, you never hold it responsible for the trouble it causes. In fact, the next time it gives advice, you're all ears. Is that rational? How many times has that voice been wrong about what was going on or what will be going on? Maybe it's worth noticing whom you're going to for advice. When you've sincerely tried these practices of self-observation and awareness, you'll see that you're in trouble. You'll realize that you've only had one problem your entire life, and you're looking at it. It's pretty much the cause of every problem you've ever had. Now the question becomes, how do you get rid of this inner troublemaker? The first thing you'll realize is that there's no hope of getting rid of it until you really want to. Until you've watched your roommate long enough to truly understand the predicament you're in, you really have no basis for practices that help you deal with the mind. Once you've made the decision to free yourself from the mental melodrama, you are ready for teachings and techniques. You will now have a real use for them. You will be relieved to know that you are not the first person to have this problem. There are those who have gone before you who found themselves in the same situation. Many of them looked for guidance from those who had mastered this field of knowledge. They were given teachings and techniques, such as yoga, which were created to help in this process. Yoga is not really about getting your body healthy, although it does that too. Yoga is about the knowledge that will help you out of your predicament, the knowledge that can free you. Once you've made this freedom the meaning of your life, there are spiritual practices that can help you. These practices are what you do with your time in order to free yourself from yourself. You will eventually catch on that you have to distance yourself from your psyche. You do this by setting the direction of your life when you're clear and not letting the wavering mind deter you. Your will is stronger than the habit of listening to that voice. There is nothing you can't do. Your will is supreme over all of this. If you want to free yourself, you must first become conscious enough to understand your predicament. Then you must commit yourself to the inner work of freedom. You do this as though your life depended on it, because it does. As it is right now, your life is not your own. It belongs to your inner roommate, the psyche. You have to take it back. Stand firm in the seat of the witness and release the hold that the habitual mind has on you. This is your life. Reclaim it. Chapter 3. Who are you? Ramana Maharshi, 1879 to 1950, a great teacher in the yogic tradition, used to say that to attain inner freedom, one must continuously and sincerely ask the question, who am I? He taught that this was more important than reading books, learning mantras, or going to holy places. Just ask, who am I? Who sees when I see? Who hears when I hear? Who knows that I am aware? Who am I? Let's explore this question by playing a game. Make believe that you and I are having a conversation. Typically, in Western cultures, when someone comes up to you and asks, excuse me, who are you? You don't admonish them for asking such a deep question. You tell them your name. For example, Sally Smith. But I'm going to challenge this response by taking out a piece of paper and writing the letters S-A-L-L-Y-S-M-I-T-H, and then showing it to you. Is that who you are? A collection of letters? Is that who sees when you see? Obviously not, so you say. Okay, you're right. I'm sorry, I'm not Sally Smith. That's just a name people call me. It's a label. Really, I'm Frank Smith's wife. No way, that's not even politically correct nowadays. How could you be Frank Smith's wife? Are you saying you didn't exist before you met Frank, and you would cease to exist if he died or you got remarried? Frank Smith's wife can't be who you are. Again, that's just another label. The result of another situation or event you participated in. But then, who are you? This time you respond, okay, now you have my attention. My label is Sally Smith. I was born in 1965 in New York. I lived in Queens with my parents, Harry and Mary Jones, until I was 5 years old. Then we moved to New Jersey and I went to Newark Elementary School. I got all A's in school, and in the fifth grade I played Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. I started dating in the ninth grade, and my first boyfriend was Joe. Then I went to Rutgers College, where I met and married Frank Smith. That is who I am. Wait a minute. That's a fascinating story, but I didn't ask you what has happened to you since you were born. I asked you, who are you? You've just described all these experiences, but who had these experiences? Wouldn't you still be in there, aware of your existence, even if you had gone to a different college? So you contemplate this, and you realize that never in your life have you asked yourself that question and really meant it. Who am I? That is what Ramana Maharshi was asking. So you ponder this more seriously and you say, okay, I am the body that is occupying this space. I am 5'6" and I weigh 135 pounds, and here I am. When you were Dorothy in the fifth grade play, you weren't 5'6", you were 4'6". So which are you? Are you the 4'6" person or are you the 5'6" person? Weren't you in there when you were Dorothy? You told me you were. Aren't you the one who had the experience of being Dorothy in the fifth grade play and is now having the experience of trying to answer my questions? Isn't this the same you? Perhaps we need to step back for a moment to ask some exploratory questions before returning to the core question. When you were 10 years old, didn't you look in the mirror and see a 10-year-old body? Wasn't that the same you that now sees an adult body? What you looked at has changed. But what about you, the one who is looking? Isn't there a continuity of being? Wasn't it the same being that looked in the mirror throughout the years? You have to contemplate this very carefully. Here's another question. When you go to sleep every night, do you dream? Who dreams? What does it mean to dream? You answer, well, it's like a motion picture plays in my mind and I watch it. Who watches it? I do. The same you who looks in the mirror? Does the same you who is listening to these words also look in the mirror and watch the dreams? When you awake, you know you saw the dream. There is a continuity of conscious awareness of being. Ramana Maharshi was just asking some very simple questions. Who sees when you see? Who hears when you hear? Who watches the dreams? Who looks at the image in the mirror? Who is it that is having all these experiences? If you try to just give honest, intuitive answers, you are simply going to say, me, it's me. I'm in here experiencing all of this. That's about the best answer you'll have. It's actually pretty easy to see that you're not the objects you look at. It's a classic case of subject-object. It's you, the subject, that is looking at the objects. So we don't have to go through every object in the universe and say that object is not you. We can very easily generalize by saying that if you are the one who is looking at something, then that something is not you. So, right away, in one fell swoop, you know what you're not. You're not the outside world. You're the one who is inside looking out at that world. That was easy. Now at least we've eliminated the countless things outside. But who are you? And where are you if you're not outside with all the other things? You just have to pay attention and realize that you would still be in there experiencing feelings, even if all the outside objects disappeared. Imagine how much fear you would feel. You might also feel frustration and even anger. But who would be feeling these things? Again, you say me, and that's the right answer. The same me experiences both the outside world and the inside emotions. To take a clear look at this, imagine that you're watching a dog play outdoors. Suddenly you hear a noise right behind you, a hiss, like a rattlesnake. Would you still be looking at the dog with the same intensity of focus? Of course not. You'd be feeling tremendous fear inside. Though the dog would still be playing in front of you, you'd be completely preoccupied with the experience of fear. All of your attention can very quickly become absorbed in your emotions. But who feels the fear? Isn't it the same you who is watching the dog? Who feels love when you feel love? Can't you feel so much love that it's hard to keep your eyes open? You can become so absorbed in beautiful inner feelings or frightening inner fears that it's hard to focus on outer objects. In essence, inside and outside objects compete for your attention. You are in there having both inner and outer experiences. But who are you? To explore this more deeply, answer another question. Don't you have times when you're not having emotional experiences and instead you just feel quiet inside? You're still in there, but you're just aware of peaceful quiet. Eventually, you will begin to realize that the outside world and the flow of inner emotions come and go. But you, the one who experiences these things, remain consciously aware of whatever passes before you. But where are you? Maybe we can find you in your thoughts. René Descartes, a great philosopher, once said, "I think, therefore I am." But is that really what's going on? The dictionary defines the verb to think as to form thoughts, to use the mind to consider ideas and make judgments. The question is, who is using the mind to form thoughts and then manipulate them into ideas and judgments? Does this experiencer of thoughts exist even when thoughts are not present? Fortunately, you don't have to think about it. You are very aware of your presence of being, your sense of existence, without the help of your thoughts. When you go into deep meditation, for example, the thoughts stop. You know that they've stopped. You don't think it. You are simply aware of no thoughts. You come back and say, "Wow, I went into this deep meditation, and for the first time, my thoughts completely stopped. I was in a place of complete peace, harmony, and quiet." If you are in there experiencing the peace that occurs when your thoughts stop, then obviously your existence is not dependent upon the act of thinking. Thoughts can stop, and they can also get extremely noisy. Sometimes you have many more thoughts than other times. You may even tell someone, "My mind is driving me crazy. Ever since he said those things to me, I can't even sleep. My mind just won't shut up." Whose mind? Who is noticing these thoughts? Isn't it you? Don't you hear your thoughts inside? Aren't you aware of their existence? In fact, can't you get rid of them? If you start to have a thought you don't like, can't you try to make it go away? People struggle with thoughts all the time. Who is it that is aware of the thoughts, and who is it that struggles with them? Again, you have a subject-object relationship with your thoughts. You are the subject, and thoughts are just another object you can be aware of. You are not your thoughts. You are simply aware of your thoughts. Finally, you say, "Fine, I'm not anything in the outside world, and I'm not the emotions. These outer and inner objects come and go, and I experience them. Plus, I'm not the thoughts. They can be quiet or noisy, happy or sad. Thoughts are just something else I'm aware of. But who am I?" It starts to become a serious question. Who am I? Who is having all these physical, emotional, and mental experiences? So you contemplate this question a little deeper. This is done by letting go of the experiences and noticing who is left. You will begin to notice who is experiencing the experience. Eventually, you will get to a point within yourself where you realize that you, the experiencer, have a certain quality. And that quality is awareness, consciousness, an intuitive sense of existence. You know that you're in there. You don't have to think about it. You just know. You can think about it if you want to, but you will know that you're thinking about it. You exist regardless, thoughts or no thoughts. To make this more experiential, let's try a consciousness experiment. Notice that with a single glance at a room or out a window, you instantaneously see the full detail of everything that's in front of you. You are effortlessly aware of all the objects that are within the scope of your vision, both near and far away. Without moving your head or eyes, you perceive all the intricate detail of what you immediately see. Look at all the colors, the variations of light, the grain of wood furniture, the architecture of buildings, and the variations of bark and leaves on trees. Notice that you take all this in at once without having to think about it. No thoughts are necessary. You just see it. Now try to use thoughts to isolate, label, and describe all the intricate detail of what you see. How long would it take your mental voice to describe all that detail to you, versus the instantaneous snapshot of consciousness just seeing? When you just look without creating thoughts, your consciousness is effortlessly aware of and fully comprehends all that it sees. Consciousness is the highest word you will ever utter. There is nothing higher or deeper than consciousness. Consciousness is pure awareness. But what is awareness? Let's try another experiment. Let's say you are in a room looking at a group of people and a piano. Now make believe the piano ceases to exist in your world. Would you have a major problem with that? You say, no, I don't think so. I'm not attached to pianos. Okay, then. Make believe the people in the room cease to exist. Are you still okay? Can you handle it? You say, sure, I like being alone. Now make believe your awareness doesn't exist. Just turn it off. How are you doing now? What would it be like if your awareness didn't exist? It's actually pretty simple. You wouldn't be there. There would be no sense of me. There wouldn't be anyone in there to say, wow, I used to be in here, but now I'm not. There would no longer be an awareness of being. And without awareness of being or consciousness, there is nothing. Are there objects? Who knows? If no one is aware of the objects, their existence or non-existence becomes completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter how many things are in front of you. If you turn off the consciousness, there is nothing. If you are conscious, however, there can be nothing in front of you, but you are fully aware that there is nothing. It's really not that complicated, and it's very enlightening. So now if I ask you, who are you? You answer, I am the one who sees. From back in here somewhere, I look out, and I am aware of the events, thoughts, and emotions that pass before me. If you go very deep, that is where you live. You live in the seat of consciousness. A true spiritual being lives there without effort and without intent. Just as you effortlessly look outside and see all that you see, you will eventually sit far enough back inside to see all your thoughts and emotions, as well as outer form. All of these objects are in front of you. The thoughts are closer in. The emotions are a little further away, and form is way out there. Behind it all, there you are. You go so deep that you realize that's where you've always been. At each stage of your life, you have seen different thoughts, emotions, and objects pass before you. But you have always been the conscious receiver of all that was. Now you are in your center of consciousness. You are behind everything, just watching. That is your true home. Take everything else away and you're still there, aware that everything is gone. But take the center of awareness away, and there is nothing. That center is the seat of self. From that seat, you are aware that there are thoughts, emotions, and a world coming in through your senses. But now you are aware that you're aware. That is the seat of the Buddhist self, the Hindu Atman, and the Judeo-Christian soul. The great mystery begins once you take that seat deep within. Chapter 4. The Lucid Self. There is a type of dream called a lucid dream in which you know that you're dreaming. If you fly in the dream, you know that you're flying. You think, hey, look, I'm dreaming that I'm flying. I'm going to fly over there. You are actually conscious enough to know that you are flying in the dream and that you are dreaming the dream. That's very different from regular dreams in which you are fully immersed in the dream. This distinction is exactly the difference between being aware that you are aware in your daily life and not being aware that you are aware. When you are an aware being, you no longer become completely immersed in the events around you. Instead, you remain inwardly aware that you are the one who is experiencing both the events and the corresponding thoughts and emotions. When a thought is created in this state of awareness, instead of getting lost in it, you remain aware that you are the one who is thinking the thought. You are lucid. This raises some very interesting questions. If you are the indwelling being who is experiencing all this, then why do these different levels of perception exist? When you are seated in the awareness of self, you are lucid. Where are you when you are not seated deeply enough inside the self to be the conscious experiencer of all you are experiencing? To begin with, consciousness has the ability to do what is called focus. It is part of the nature of consciousness. The essence of consciousness is awareness, and awareness has the ability to become more aware of one thing and less aware of something else. In other words, it has the ability to focus itself on certain objects. The teacher says, concentrate on what I'm saying. What does that mean? It means focus your consciousness on one place. Teachers figure you know how to do that. Who taught you how to do that? What class in high school taught you how to take your consciousness and move it somewhere in order to focus on something? Nobody taught you this. It was intuitive and natural. You've always known how to do it. So we do know that consciousness exists. We just don't normally talk about it. You probably went through grade school, high school, and college without anyone discussing the nature of consciousness. Fortunately, the nature of consciousness has been studied very closely in deep teachings such as yoga. In fact, the ancient teachings of yoga are all about consciousness. The best way to learn about consciousness is through your own direct experience. For example, you know very well that your consciousness can be aware of a wide field of objects, or it can be so focused on one object that you are unaware of anything else. This is what happens when you get lost in thought. You can be reading, and then suddenly you're not reading anymore. It happens all the time. You just start thinking about something else. Outside objects or mental thoughts can catch your attention at any time, but it's still the same awareness whether it is focused on the outside or on your thoughts. The key is that consciousness has the ability to concentrate on different things. The subject, consciousness, has the ability to selectively focus awareness on specific objects. If you step back, you will clearly see that objects are constantly passing before you at all three levels, mental, emotional, and physical. When you're not centered, your consciousness invariably gets attracted toward one or more of those objects and focuses on them. If it concentrates enough, your sense of awareness loses itself in the object. It is no longer aware that it is aware of the object, it just becomes object conscious. Have you ever noticed that when you're deeply absorbed in watching TV, you have no awareness of where you're sitting or what else is going on in the room? The TV analogy is perfect for examining how our center of consciousness shifts from awareness of self to being lost in the objects we're focused on. The difference is that instead of sitting in your living room getting absorbed in the TV, you're sitting in your center of consciousness getting absorbed in the screens of mind, emotions, and outside images. When you concentrate on the world of physical senses, it draws you in. Then your emotional and mental reactions draw you in further. At that point, you are no longer sitting in the centered self. You are absorbed in the inner show you're watching. Let's look at your inner show. You have an underlying pattern of thoughts that goes on around you all the time. This pattern of thoughts stays pretty much the same. You are as familiar and comfortable with your normal thought patterns as you are with the living space of your home. You also have emotions that are your norm, a certain amount of fear, a certain amount of love, and a certain amount of insecurity. You know that if certain things happen, one or more of these emotions will flare up and dominate your awareness. Then, eventually, they will settle back down to the norm. You know this so well that you are very busy inside making sure nothing happens to create these disturbances. In fact, you are so preoccupied with controlling your world of thoughts, emotions, and physical sensations that you don't even know you're in there. That is the normal state for most people. When you are in this lost state, you get so totally absorbed in the objects of thought, feelings, and the senses that you forget the subject. Right now, you are sitting in the center of consciousness watching your personal TV show. But there are so many interesting objects distracting your consciousness that you can't help but get drawn into them. It's overwhelming. It's three-dimensional. It's all around you. All of your senses draw you in. Sight, sound, taste, smell, and touch, as well as your feelings and your thoughts. But you are really sitting quietly inside looking out at all these objects. Just as the sun does not leave its position in the sky to illuminate objects with its radiating light, so consciousness does not leave its center to project awareness onto the objects of form, thoughts, and emotions. If you ever want to recenter, just start saying hello inside, over and over. Then notice that you are aware of that thought. Don't think about being aware of it. That's just another thought. Simply relax and be aware that you can hear hello being echoed in your mind. That is your seat of centered consciousness. Now let's move from the small screen to the big one. Let's study consciousness using the example of a movie. When you go to a movie, you let yourself get drawn in. It's part of the experience of watching the movie. With a movie, you use two senses, seeing and hearing. And it's very important that these senses synchronize. You wouldn't get as involved in the film if they didn't. Imagine if you were watching a James Bond movie and the soundtrack didn't synchronize with the scenes. Instead of getting drawn into the magical world,